welcome in the latest episode of that SEC podcast. I'm your host, Michael Bratton. Go by SEC Mike on Twitters. And there's our great friend, Stephen Lassen, the senior editor over at Athlon Sports. Stephen, how are you? You surviving with this magazine coming, the writing of it coming to an end?
I am surviving, my friend. I am, I guess, energized by the fact that we had some spring games this weekend. We got the NFL draft going on this week. So football's keeping me going because we have reached the home stretch. And that means like the energy level is like winding down at this point. It's like having 400 carries and a running back in a season. That's like happened since the national championship game as we try to get this magazine. We're getting close, though. That's the good news. The bad news is we've got a long way to go in terms of content turning around.
Yeah, I don't know about you, Stephen. I was talking to my dad today, and he said, you know, for him, football really, of course, he's kind of a nut like I am, but he said football really kicks into gear after the draft. So, yeah. Hey, that's this week, as you said. Shane and I are going to be doing a watch-along with all the cousins during the draft. So, cousins, if you want to watch a draft, or heck, even if you don't, you just want to hear us BS about it. So, come hang out with us Thursday, live show. So that should be pretty fun. But Stephen and I, we got some work to do before we get there. To get the cousins to the draft, Stephen, we're going to be debating the defining topics, discussions, however you want to say it, that will define the Athlon Sports College Football Preview Magazine ranking. So a lot of work via Stephen to discuss, you know, what's going on behind the scenes. What is he debating with this team, that team? I mean, I don't envy you, Stephen. I'll just put it that way.
Mike, the good news is I have not started the SEC predictions yet. So I'm hoping to use like tonight's show as kind of like a good research jumping off point. I will tell you the bad news is, and I will say it's a good thing you're not like Pac-12 Mike, Mountain West Mike tonight, because man, you know, the transfer portal, we talk about all the entries coming into the SEC. There are so many teams like in these group of six conferences that have basically like one returning starter, zero returning starters, and they all have like 40 to 50 transfers. So it's a little easier in the SEC in terms of just figuring out like who's back and who's gone. But it is this is the most challenging part of the process, but it's also like the most fun as we try to piece together what's going to happen this year.
Right. And I don't know if you remember, Stephen, but you know, all the way back, I don't even know how long you've been on this show, but years and years and years. We are very appreciative for all your appearances, but I can recall, you know, 5-6 years ago, maybe it was, where, you know, asking you, is it harder than ever to make these preseason predictions? And you said yes, but I would imagine you yearn for the days of just 5 years ago to figure this stuff out.
Yeah, it's like harder times like 100 since that point. I thought, man, like this was hard. Like this is even harder. I mentioned like the transfer portal. We've got a conference that doesn't even have a schedule yet. Conference USA still trying to figure out like Louisiana Tech. They don't have a schedule yet. So we're dealing with that. There's just so much more uncertainty with every team. I would also argue that we know less about these teams right now than we did compared to 5 years ago. Certainly, you know, 10 years ago, maybe like pre-portal movement. I found a spreadsheet sometime during the football season that I did years ago on transfers, and there was like maybe 100. There's like 100 transfers in like the day when the portal gets going. So it just goes to show you how things have quickly changed in college football, but also like how volatile this is. I mean, we've seen Indiana take a step forward to win the national championship. We've seen what kind of impact it has on the SEC year to year. So the volatility is very hard to figure out, but it's also kind of like what makes college football fun, right? We get to see like which teams are going to be much, much better this year.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, if we knew who was going to do it, I don't think it'd be near as fun on Saturdays to watch. So we'll get into that in just a second, but I did want to ask you, Stephen, again, I know you've been very busy and they are doing everything in their power to keep spring football under wraps. And I mean, heck, hardly anybody televises it anymore. And really, you got to go to secondary sources to get all this stuff. But based on what you did see over the weekend, anything stand out from any of this, the spring action, whether it was a spring game or even I know some are still practicing. Did anything stand out to you this over the week?
Mike, I'm going to start with a complaint, because it's kind of like last week. There's no spring portal window. What are we trying to hide here? TV, give me a Saturday of spring games from start to finish. I always say, take it with a grain of salt. Don't overreact. But of course, I would have watched every second of all 16 SEC teams, and I probably would have overreacted to some of the things that I saw. I think there was a particular thing on Saturday that I was interested in, and that was Auburn to see Byron Brown, see Alex Golish, and see that debut. You know, Byron Brown didn't have the best Saturday. I'm not really that worried. I think you did kind of see Alex Golish kind of pushing some of his skill players, you know, Bryson Washington, some of the receivers that transferred in from South Florida, kind of emphasizing that, hey, we got to be better this offseason in order to elevate this offense to the next level. So I was very interested to see Auburn. Obviously, maybe not the fireworks we anticipated from Byron Brown, but I think they're going to be fine in the regular season. I think on the other side, Mike, I know Oklahoma wasn't televised, but I think everything you read out of spring practice for Oklahoma, and the same thing is true for Georgia. I think Georgia looks really impressive. No surprise. They've won the SEC the last 2 years. I'm just impressed continuously by the roster depth that they've accumulated. Like, the young talent continues to flash. I think the offense is going to be a lot better this year. I think John Mateer is going to take a step forward, like some of the skill talent that we've seen this spring. So I think Oklahoma and Georgia on the positive side, I think my confidence level probably grew a little bit after reading, watching things out of those two camps this spring.
Hey, I heard an interesting interview. I never had this guy on. Maybe I should at some point, but he does a heck of a job. Dusty Dvorak, ESPN, yeah. Former Sooner great. I just heard a comment he made today. I believe it was today, Stephen. But he basically said he thinks Oklahoma overachieved last year, which I think to some degree is. And you know, again, he wasn't criticizing necessarily, but he said he thinks this Oklahoma team has got a higher ceiling. Now, he didn't say better record or anything like that, but that was the only comment that I heard. I'm just curious your thoughts on it, and if you would, you know, again, not that you're outright predicting anything, but would you agree with that assessment or disagree?
I would agree with that. I think we've kind of talked about that too with Texas A&M is, you know, A&M felt like they were getting to the playoff a year ahead of schedule. I think you could argue for Oklahoma too, coming into the season, you know, expectations were kind of all over the map. There were some that had them close to the playoff, making the playoff. I think I had them closer to 15 in my preseason power ranking, so I was a little bit off on that one. But I do think the schedule, just 9 games in the SEC, you have to play at Georgia, you got to play at Michigan, Florida, Texas A&M, and of course there's the big one against Texas in Dallas. Like, the schedule feels a lot harder. So, I mean, schedule was hard last year too. It feels like with those road games, and given the way that we kind of think about the 9-game SEC schedule, I could see this team not being 10-2. I could see them being 9-3, but also think that still might be good enough to make the playoffs. So just, I think they did make the playoff a year ahead of schedule. Do wonder if their record isn't better, but they're just a better overall team. And I think that might play out with a couple teams in the SEC this year, just given the 9-game difficulty of the SEC schedule.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we may have even discussed this, Stephen. I can't really recall. But speaking of Oklahoma, you know, Texas playing Ohio State. I'm trying to think if there's any other SEC Big Ten action. You know, how important could these games be for playoff implications for really both conferences? Like if the Big Ten wins both, or if the SEC wins both. Again, I know it's much more complicated than that, but it could go perhaps in favor of one conference or the other come playoff time. Would you agree with that?
I would, because I mean, think about like trying to seed these teams, and if Oklahoma goes up to Michigan and wins, Texas beats Ohio State. If you're sitting in that playoff committee room, you know, and we hope that they evaluate strength of schedule better this year and going forward, you're sitting there saying, okay, well, two of the best teams in the SEC beat two of the better teams from the Big Ten. Also, Mississippi State playing at Minnesota. Now, this game could actually, when you start talking about like depth in conferences, and this is going to come up probably more like on social media and like radio shows, but like, what if Mississippi State goes up to Minnesota and wins that game, and Minnesota finishes like top half of the Big Ten, eighth, you know, ninth, 10th, somewhere in there. I mean, for the SEC, if you think Mississippi State is 14th, 15th, and they go on the road and beat Minnesota, and those two games play out, Texas beats Ohio State, Oklahoma beats Michigan, like that's kind of taken into account the depth that we always talk about in this conference. And certainly for playoff seeding, trying to position these teams, I think it would absolutely matter. So I would say, if Greg Sankey probably emphasizing to Steve Sarkisian and Brent Venables like how important these games are so that they can maybe quiet some of those Big Ten guys up, right?
Yeah, hey, Clyde, that's why we have you on, Stephen, because again, you would never even overlook Mississippi State like I did. But hey, we all know the Bulldogs. They're always better at the beginning of the year than the end. So at least under Jim Phillippe. So hopefully they can get one for the SEC. 3-0 sweep certainly would be nice.
Yeah, Mike, I think that is one of those games. Mississippi State at Minnesota is one of those games that is not going to be like on the national radar, but will tell us a lot about Mississippi State, especially just because of, you know, I'm very high in Kamario Taylor. I would love to see this defense take a step forward in Zach Arnett's return there. And I think early in the season, you get Louisiana Monroe in week one. That's a game that Mississippi State is going to be a big time favorite. But to go on the road and play Minnesota and then at South Carolina, it feels like we're going to have a pretty good idea where this team is after those three games. And if you want to start thinking bowl eligibility, I think you got to get that one at Minnesota just because it's really going to be hard to claw wins away in the SEC.
Mm-hmm. All right, Steven, let us delay no longer. Oh, wait, one other. Let us delay a moment longer. Which, thankfully, this is good for you with the magazine and everything. But Owen Heineke, eligible. So now that'll be in the magazine. So you'll have that information. So I know you're thankful for the Oklahoma court system. Just not necessarily that you're rooting for one team or over the other, but that they expedited this so that you would know. What does that do for Oklahoma and their defense, which we already anticipate being very good, but getting one of their better players back?
Yeah, I appreciate the SEC speed at which they made this decision because it makes my life like 100 times easier than not sweating this out on deadline. Mike, I think you said it best. It's like another kind of chess piece on the board for Brent Venables. I mean, we know they do have some turnover up front. I do like, you know, Kip Lewis coming back at linebacker, some of the other pieces they have on this defense. It's just already another piece on kind of like the confidence meter that this defense is really not going to miss that much of a beat. Certainly the losses up front are huge, but I trust Brent Venables to figure it out. And now you add another piece in there. I think it just kind of gives you confidence that they're still going to be very, very good in 2026.
And shout out JP. He was at the game. He said, I was there. OU defense is better than last year. I mean, that's some bold comments, but Steven, everybody's undefeated in right now. So now is the time for these bold kind of statements. You know what?
So also, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like the perfect time for optimism. Everybody is zero. Everybody's going to go to the playoff and win the national title. You know, Danny Okoye was a guy at Oklahoma who really popped all spring. And you start thinking like if the next wave of superstars is starting to emerge on that defensive front, this defense is going to be just fine. So I love, you know, spring things to overreact, Mike, because it just adds to the optimism level and kind of our, you know, kind of like grain of salt theory. Like, what do you take from spring games? But then you have guys who are really standing out and could make or break the season for some of these teams.
Yeah, on Rocky Top, we always think it feels like 98 this time of year. So take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. But all right, Steven, let's get into show topic for today. And maybe before you reveal your first talking point, storyline, what have you, maybe could you explain to the cousins maybe a little bit more in depth what the factors that you're going into here that led to these storylines for you?
Yeah, Mike, this is a great idea that you came up with. And, you know, it got me thinking about trying to talk about the factors that I'm thinking about as I'm putting together the magazine and putting together the predictions. And I think it's important, you know, I love to like beat up on the playoff committee for their lack of transparency and their metrics that are like under lock and key and everything like that. I want to be transparent and I want to kind of give the Cousins like, hey, here's what I am evaluating. Here's what I'm thinking about big picture and also on the team level. And so I sat down, you know, yesterday and came up with about, you know, 20 or 30 things for the SEC that I'm thinking about for this year. But those 20 or 30 things go team, conference, and I'm using those as a way to, as I'm going through teams, as I'm going through the schedule, these are the things that are going to make or break or guide me on those predictions. So trying to give the Cousins a little bit of transparency on some of my thinking into these predictions for this year.
Okay, fantastic. So what would be the very first storyline that you're kind of centered on this offseason?
Mike, I think I'd be curious to see if you agree with me on this one. I think in the past, we would wait what happened the previous year a lot more. Like if there was very limited portal movement, we would know the roster just simply turns over. Sophomores become juniors, juniors become seniors. And I think you felt a lot better. But I think this plays into what we talked about at the start of the show. How much do priors matter in this discussion? Because I think we know less about these teams than we ever have before about the portal. Because of the portal, it's going to make for a heck of a season. But I wonder, when we evaluate these teams, what percentage of weight on previous seasons and success matters in 2026?
Oh, shout out to Danny here. Appreciate you. Yeah, this is right, Danny. Danny, appreciate you. Hey, cuz this might be a topic for another show, but what would be your record predictions for each team if they lost their starting quarterback for the season due to injury or bad performance? So I like that question.
I love that idea.
Maybe we'll do that next time we meet up, Stephen. Because I don't want to get too off topic here. That could take us quite a while. But to go back to your point, you know, I think this really hit home for me last season, Stephen, when Ole Miss was virtually dead last in everything, returning production, and they lasted longer than any of the SEC teams. Now, were they the best? Debatable. I mean, Georgia, you know, of course they beat Georgia when it really mattered. So maybe they were the best, but point being is, you know, there's a reason I haven't done my returning statistic show. Cause I'm like, I don't even know what the heck's the point of that anymore. And the way some of these top level teams are working, like, you know, again, we'll see, but Tennessee, new defensive staff, importing all this talent, expectations are the defense is going to be pretty good on Rocky Top. Auburn, now again a little bit different, but importing all these players from the coach's last stop. The expectations at Auburn is we're going to have a really good offense. So, yeah, I mean that is a great question, and that doesn't mean you can just kind of import all the pieces you need and you're going to be just fine. That's certainly not what I'm saying. And I think Georgia will really test that this offseason where, you know, everybody's, who's the next Indiana? Who's this, that, and the other? Well, Georgia's going a little old school with a ton of experience back, continuity at coordinator and quarterback. And I think in a normal year, without the portal, without all this stuff, I think Georgia would be unanimous number one. But now that teams can supplement, now I think it's a little bit more up for debate. But yeah, I think that is, I think that's one of the million-dollar questions this preseason.
I think that's also why you're going to see some people take a swing on some teams. Like you and I have talked about Kentucky and why Kentucky might be getting some top 25 buzz, even though the record was what it was last year, and certainly have some question marks about all the transition. I do think because of the, hey, let's just throw returning production. Let's throw these things out the window. There's, you know, I mentioned on some of these G5 rosters, I mean, there's, or G6 rosters, 50 to 60 new players. I mean, like, what does last year's stats mean? They probably don't mean anything. I think they matter. You know, I still think we have to take into account what happened last year, know the records, know the stats, but I think the percentage of like weight that I would have put on that in a prediction discussion is probably a heck of a lot less than I would have 3 years ago, certainly 5-10 years ago. So I think a lot of discussion in the past may have been looking back, but I think now it's definitely like Portal, what they've brought in, and just looking forward, because these rosters are so much built, assembled from year to year for 1 year success, and then you build again for the next year.
Yeah, and I also wonder, Stephen, playing a part of that, when you bring in a transfer that for whatever reason didn't necessarily hit at his previous institution, you got to figure out why. Was it the coaching? Was it the scheme? Was it injury? I mean, how many times do you add someone? I'll give you a good example. Now, maybe it's just because I'm kind of ignorant of the other conferences. I'm not saying he was a bad player. He was just totally under my radar. But Kyle Kennard going to South Carolina. Like, I didn't view that as some five-star. You can correct me if I'm wrong, Stephen. Of how productive he was at Georgia Tech. But I don't think anybody was like, oh, God, well, they just added SEC Defensive Player of the Year, which I believe he was. I mean, you know, there you got to try to unearth those players as well.
Yeah, I think on the Kennard example, I thought he was going to end up being like a solid player. I think he blew the expectations from most people out of the water. And I think maybe there is a discussion of, there are so many transfers and we get so excited about them because, you know, it's like trying to find something new. Somebody's going to hit. You need a receiver. You got this guy coming in. There's like a supply and demand thing here too, that, yeah, you brought in X amount of players, but the talent level in the portal, maybe it's not as high as it was previous year. So I think there could also be a discussion along with that, is like, when there's so many players that are on the move, there probably are some guys who slip through the cracks because they could be good system fit somewhere else. Like, they didn't work out necessarily here, but maybe they fit better in this role for this team. So that's kind of why I think I've shifted my thinking on a lot of these, to say, in the past, you weighted a lot of like past records, you weighted the stats. I think now it's like you acknowledge them, but I think you're mostly just looking through the windshield and not the rearview mirror.
Hey, shout out to Carl. He might be your biggest fan, Stephen. Yes, I love Lassen. He is brilliant and humble. I'd listen to Stephen read the phone book. Stephen, please start your own podcast, bro. So there you go. Carl loves you, man.
Carl, I appreciate you. Thanks for the comment. I really appreciate that. It's during the dog days of magazine production and I'm tired and everything. So thank you. Can we start a branch of like that SEC podcast and I can just host whenever?
That Stephen podcast. Right. Yeah, we'll break it out ASAP as soon as you're done with the magazine. And shout out Liquid too. I didn't want this to go unnoticed. Stephen is the yin to Marler's yang. Lassen the assassin and Marler the big baby. What rhymes with Barker? Thanks for all the deep dives and info, Stephen. So we appreciate you, Liquid member for 20 months. Wow.
Shout out to Liquid. Always appreciate him stopping by. Mike, what's the deal with Marler? Is he starting like beefs with, you know, the Indiana defensive coordinator and all this? But
he's starting beefs with anybody that'll talk to him.
See, I thought his suspension, you know, was like, you know, supposed to set him, you know, straight here, and we're back to the old ways, I guess.
That lasted about a week, and now he's back to foaming at the mouth and cussing people out. So, you are the perfect yin to his yang. That was well said by Liquid.
I do think Marler's wrong about, what is it? You asked him earlier today, the sleeper team, whether it was like Auburn or Florida. I think Florida.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on, Stephen, to your number two talking point here.
Mike, this is one of my most intriguing just national storylines, the 9-game SEC schedule. I want to throw my computer out the window frequently when I see people say we can evaluate teams fairly now that everybody's playing the same amount of conference games. Complete nonsense. There are differences between nine games here and nine games there. Who you also play makes a big difference. But I think the bottom line with the schedule, Mike, is that nine games in the SEC just adds to the difficulty, which also adds to what does it mean for the playoff? What does it mean for, you know, trying to get to the conference championship game? A lot harder, five home, four road for a lot of these teams, taking out the neutral sites. It's a new variable. And I do think the committee is going to have a hard time evaluating strength of schedule fairly based upon what we saw last year. So nine games SEC, I'm very interested to see how it works in theory and also interested to see how it plays out in terms of the standings.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be fascinating, isn't it? And thankfully, I can't believe they didn't work this out prior, but, you know, two bye weeks guaranteed. For anybody that's missed it, the NCAA has made that official. Unfortunately, not starting this season, but moving forward. So that will help. It's almost unforgivable to me to have a nine-game conference slate with an added power four opponent and only have one bye. But that's neither here nor there. Any thought to... Of course, I mean, this is almost always the case, so I don't know how much this would factor in, Stephen, but you would assume that you need a deeper roster to win this conference now, which, again, that's kind of captain obvious, but, you know, is there a difference between high-end talent and a roster with more competitive depth, if that makes sense? You know, could that affect the teams that are left standing at the end of the season in this conference?
That's a really good question, Mike, because I wonder if everybody is going to be struggling for the same thing. Like everybody's going to be the main contenders, essentially. You know, like Ohio State's a good example. Just they lost a lot of guys to the portal. They transferred to go start elsewhere. We saw this with Texas. I mean, Texas just picked up two transfers. I think one from Michigan State. The other one was from, I think, Brown. I mean, maybe that's like filling out the back end of the roster, trying to add some quality depth of guys who've played played FBS or FCS at a high level. I think everybody's kind of struggling for it. And so like when you look at Ohio State, I look at Oregon, I look at Texas, I look at all these teams and go, I think they're all going to be struggling with it. I think the other side of it is who's going to be like the most fortunate team. And it's like, I know some people would say that's like a dirty word to say like they were lucky. It's not, it's like, who can avoid the worst injuries during the season? Is it like who can start all five offensive linemen for every game is a really big deal and a big bonus in terms of the season. So I do think depth questions are huge. I don't know how to quantify that though, in terms of like a season thing, because it feels like we're still so new in this 12 team era. Maybe by the end of this year, we'll have a much better idea of kind of like the impact of some of these moves, because only four teams have made the 12 team playoff in both years, Indiana, Ohio State, Oregon, and Georgia. And that just kind of shows you like the volatility of, hey, there could be a handful of spots up for grabs again, because the 2-year trend tells us that there's going to be a lot of turnover again.
Mm-hmm. And I know this may be going a little too far down the old conspiracy rabbit hole, Stephen, but could you imagine a situation where it doesn't matter the team, but let's just say, just because I'm going to assume that most people have Georgia and Texas as their top contenders in the Southeast, but this could apply to anybody. Could you envision a scenario where one of those teams is either undefeated or one loss going into like the final week of the season? And I guess it would really apply to maybe Texas more than Georgia, but where you could sit a key player like an Arch Manning against A&M. I know that might sound like blasphemy, but if you're basically already guaranteed a spot in the playoff and you don't want to play in Atlanta. You know, and again, not that they'd be like, oh, Arch is, he's trying to win the Heisman, let's sit his ass. But, you know, maybe he got a little banged up in the last game. And they're like, well, why risk it? You know, and if we don't make Atlanta, oh, man, oh, we don't have to play Georgia again or whoever. And he'd have to take more beatings before going into the playoff. Could you see a situation where a team sits key players at the end of the season in essence to avoid the SEC championship, to avoid extra, you know, toll on the body? I mean, is that crazy to even suggest?
I don't think it's necessarily crazy. I would have a hard time. Like, I know Arch and A&M is kind of like the most extreme example, but I think if you want to, like, the last week of the season is those rivalry games. You want to win those games, like, for bragging rights, for recruiting, all those purposes. I think maybe in the big picture, and I think this is kind of where I could see it coming into play. This is why we don't need to expand to 16. It's why we don't need to expand to 24. We don't need the extra stuff. Like, I think keeping the season as meaningful as possible so that way everybody's all in on X amount of games. I think if you start expanding the playoff, you open your kind of the door up for those opportunities. Also, the other factor in this is, do you really want the first round bye in the playoff? Because it hasn't worked out well for a lot of the teams so far in the first 2 years. So there could be value in just trying to, you know, keep playing, keep the momentum going. And of course, you know, what happens with the conference championship games too, I think is a big question too.
Mm-hmm. And apologies, Stephen, if I've said this with you before. I've said it with Shane about 26 times. He's tired of hearing it. I'm sure the cousins are tired as well. But when we go 9-game, one thing that I've really kind of focused on this offseason, and this may be totally irrelevant, but I don't think it will be, Stephen. Again, with a 9-game SEC and one bye week, there are certain games on the schedule that I would have circled, and this is my prime example. Tennessee at South Carolina. Most people do not have respect for South Carolina. We all know that's a very hostile place. If the situation, well, I mean, it's a hostile place regardless, but especially at night. But why I'm highlighting that, Stephen, is because that's Tennessee's 8th game in 8 weeks, and Carolina's coming off a bye, so they'll have 2 weeks to prepare for that game. So this is one where I'd say, I mean, I don't know the number, but I'll try to ballpark it, Stephen, where maybe 75% of casual college football fans will say, oh, sure, Tennessee will beat Carolina. Carolina wasn't good last year, but you got to watch out for games like that.
Yeah.
And here's another one. Now, people will laugh at this, but Ole Miss in the Egg Bowl, Mississippi State, they should be a huge favorite, right? And I'm sure they will be. But 8th game in 8 weeks, that's going to take its toll. And there's several of these on the schedule, which, again, they may not all pan out this way. But I think that is something to highlight is how difficult that's going to be for these teams.
I totally agree, especially, you know, from our earlier conversation about depth, too. You know, what does playing 7-8 straight weeks of games in the SEC take a toll? Like, you know, I know in the Ole Miss example, they play Wofford like before, like a little bit of a break before you play the big game. But Mike, you know, you mentioned Tennessee. I'm just sitting there thinking, at Arkansas, the game against Alabama, and at South Carolina, that's like a nightmare like combination of like games around Alabama, isn't it?
No doubt.
I mean, you mentioned the kind of the extended stretch of games. But we saw South Carolina almost beat A&M last year. I know it was on the road. They almost beat Alabama. Like, I think they're much more dangerous. I know we covering the SEC know that as opposed to some people nationally. But a week after playing Alabama, given the extended stretch of games, got like trap game just written all over it for Tennessee. So I think, you know, rest, stretches, depth, trap games, like those are all kind of like X factors that we have to factor in. And I've always subscribed to the theory, every team's probably going to lose one game and there's probably going to be a game where it's either closer or they lose that you don't expect. And you look at those early win totals that whether FanDuel or some of these other places have put out, they're not projecting an SEC team higher, like to be in double digits. It's like 9.5, whereas every other conference does. So I think that kind of shows, I think, what everyone is in the sports books and online sports books are thinking, is that this 9-game schedule compounded with depth concerns and lack of bye weeks is going to take a toll on some of those win totals this year.
Yeah, and here's another one, Stephen. LSU at Auburn. 8th game in 8 weeks. Now, they got a cupcake or two in there, so maybe not as daunting, but again, it's less about who you play. It's more about 8 games in 8 weeks and just how difficult that's going to be for a lot of these programs. So just something to think about as we're, you know, adding another layer to this never-before-done 9-game SEC conference schedule.
Didn't we see, would you agree, we thought Alabama kind of ran down of steam a little bit last year in that stretch before they got to a bye week, I think like in October?
Yeah, I think that's more than fair.
And could be even worse this year, where you only have one off week and 9 games in the SEC. So I think these fears are, you know, fears, concerns are completely reasonable in trying to figure out a projection for this conference.
And how about that? I mean, Bama's got, now it is technically 7 weeks, but 4 road games in 6 games. That's not easy either.
Right. Yeah. Especially, I mean, that first half of the season for Alabama, I think they should start 3-0. But you have to go to Mississippi State before playing Georgia. Then, oh, you've got to turn around and play Tennessee. And then, of course, there's the big game against Texas A&M. So that 4-game, 5-game stretch starting with South Carolina at home all the way to A&M at home is going to be very tricky for Alabama. Plus the whole they've played X amount of games in weeks number two.
Well, Stephen, I think in order to survive these schedules, you're going to need some rest and you're going to need some Cheers. So go check them out. Friends of the show, cheershealth.com. Promo code THATSEC to get you 20% off, Stephen, your entire order over at cheershealth.com. There's a link in the show notes, so go check it out yourself. But what is this Cheers, Stephen? This is getting me through the offseason here. It's an after alcohol aid. So after your last drink, or right before bedtime, you just take your Cheers, and they are saying, Stephen, that you're going to feel 50% better or your money back. That's like, you know, what LSU's trying to do with Brian Kelly. Get their damn money back, but they can't do it because it's not a guarantee like Cheers. Cheershealth.com/thatSEC. Get you some aid. It helps you with your sleep, helps you with your liver. And I'm telling you, you'll feel 50% better, or you can get your money back with cheershealth.com, promo code THATSEC. You can't beat that. I think, Stephen, I'm going to send you some Cheers. I know you're not drinking, but you probably need it with all this work you're doing on the magazine.
Yeah, we need anything to keep us awake and alert. And so, Mike, if Cheers is going to keep me going, you know I'm all in on it. Is there an SEC fan base or coach that you think needs some Cheers right about now?
I mean, all of them, but who needs it the most? I would think right now, Stephen, the one that needs it the most is gotta be, give me Texas, because they're drinking that Kool-Aid that they're going to win this national championship. Arch is going to win the Heisman. So I can only imagine the beverages that are being consumed down in Austin and in the great state of Texas right now because of they're drinking the Kool-Aid, and hell, that applies to A&M as well. I mean, I saw Billy Lucci tweeting out today, Elko's 12-4 against SEC. Come on, brother, it's a new era. So, I mean, it's playoff or bust in College Station. It feels like these days.
I would agree. Yeah, I think certainly I think we're big believers in Mike Elko, but yeah, I could see maybe the need for cheers given the fact, of course, they had Damian Stanford get hurt in the spring game, some anxiety on the injury, some anxiety on coaching hires, quarterback development. I could go with that one. A&M, maybe Tennessee too. Anxiety over quarterbacks and defensive performance maybe.
Yes, they better not be drinking in Knoxville right now until they get this quarterback situation. So, but I tell you who needs it too, Steven, is our other great Steven. Steven Up!
He's showing up for them boys in Tuscaloosa. It's Steven Up. Roll Tide.
Thank you, Steven Up. He says, always appreciate your insight. Lassen, the assassin. Thanks for helping us cousins get through the off season.
Appreciate you, Steven Up. I think we got some Alabama talk coming up, don't we, Mike?
Oh, you know it. Yeah. So let us go on with the conversation. See, what would be that next storyline that you've got this offseason?
I think gauging the impact of new coaches and coordinators. Every year we see it. This is kind of tied into like somebody's going to take a shot on one team to be this year's Indiana, and it's likely a team that's hired a new coach or the coordinator hits. You know, like 6 new coaches in the SEC, so there's a ton of turnover at the top. There's a ton of turnover at the coordinator spots. Guys like Will Muschamp, you know, Kendall Briles, interested to see the impact of that. So one of the biggest, I think, parts of the any kind of prediction process for me is just coaching impact at large, like trending up, trending down, and sort of new coaching impact and also new coordinators that are going to make an impact right away.
Mm-hmm. And so obviously when we talk new coaches, we got to talk LSU and Lane Kiffin. Is that it seemingly has got to be the program, right? That again, there's not going to be another Indiana. That's kind of crazy, but I understand literally everybody's asking that. Who's going to be the next Indiana? But the team that makes a change that, I mean, years ago, right, you would have, oh, okay, we'll build up to year 3. If that's Kiffin's plan, he might legitimately not be there by year 3. They demand, you know, some winning now. Is that the team that, again, I don't want to look multiple seasons ahead, but you know, instant impact. Hopefully we can get to the playoff this year. Hopefully we can win the whole thing in year 2. If there's one new coach to get that done, is that most likely Lane Kiffin in your mind?
I think so. And I think whether it's whatever dollar figure that roster ended up, whether it's like 20, 30, 40 million, whatever it is. I mean, they're not paying Kiffin to just finish 8-4. Like the expectation is we got to get to the playoff to take that step forward. Certainly contending for the national championship would be great. Albeit first season, I think playoff is a pretty reasonable goal. I would probably venture to say LSU and Kiffin probably going to be one of the higher rated teams in most rankings with a first year coach. There'd be some others that I think get consideration, but by far the biggest impact trying to sort out is what kind of turnaround LSU is going to have in 2026.
Now, let me ask you this, because I'd love to play the opposite side here with you, Stephen, where, yeah, I mean, you asked Cousin Shane, Ole Miss going back into the gutter. I don't know what it is that these great fans have done to Shane to get him to be so disrespectful, them Ole Miss Rebels. But I think anyone other than an LSU fan would tell you that Lane Kiffin, he seems to be chronically online. of course he's always kind of been that way, but I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but he seems to have amped it up even this off season. And there have been, I mean, it's far more than rumors. I was hearing this stuff well before he left Ole Miss, that there was distractions, personal life stuff. This is why we're losing to Kentucky at home. We don't have the team prepared. And here's another. Now, I don't think personal stuff, to my knowledge, had anything to do with. Again, we were awesome last year, right? We damn near won the national championship, Steven. And this was not a fluke. I'm sure you'll remember this because you're a sicko like me. You watch all these games. They damn near lost to Washington State last year.
Yeah.
I don't understand it for the life of me, but Kiffin could not get the team ready early games at home unless it was a big game. Then they'd get up. But I say all that to say this, Stephen. I mean, Pete Golding is not taking over Mississippi State. No offense, Mississippi State. He's taken over a playoff program that not just made the playoff, won multiple games, came a play or two away from going to the national championship. He's not walking into a situation that needs a lot of overhaul. He's walking into a situation where maybe, just maybe, they have a head coach now that is more focused. I mean, certainly, there's so much we could say about Kiffin, but I don't think we're ever going to get, Pete Golding constantly online. I don't think we're going to get Pete Golding talking to Florida behind our back. I don't think we're going to get Pete Golding talking to LSU behind our back, on and on and on. We may very well, and I'm not, I mean, it's ridiculous to sit here and say Pete Golding's better head coach than Lane Kiffin today, but by the end of the year, that conversation may be valid if Ole Miss makes the playoff and LSU doesn't. Is there a chance that Ole Miss, maybe this, in a weird way, they come out on the other side better?
I think the biggest thing, Mike, with Golding is that it's almost like no drama. It's coming from, like, I would have Kiffin among, my top coaches in the SEC. I haven't done the official list yet, but he would clearly rank among the best in the SEC and nationally. But every coach has positives and cons. And, Golding just seems like, hey, no drama, all ball, spot the ball, let's go. And I think it's kind of, I don't want to say a tone shift, but, I think that'll play well with this team because it is a very veteran team. And I think the biggest thing that benefits him is they kept Trinidad. They kept Kewon Lacy. They've got two massive pieces who could be All-Americans this year. I know for sure I'm probably going to have Kewon Lacy first team All-America on my ballot. Trinidad Chambliss will be in discussion for that as well. But I think he's kind of the right coach for the moment here. He's basically stepping into like a Ferrari that's going 200 miles an hour. The keys are in it. Just get in and go. You've been with these guys. You can keep it going. It'd be a different story. And I think if they were starting from scratch, I would understand a lot of the skepticism. It is very hard to go from interim coach, seizing the moment, maintaining momentum, to being the guy who's got to be in that seat from signing day to the end of the season. It is completely different. And so I can understand that there would be some thought on regression. But I think when I look at this roster, I go, there's a good chance that they take a step forward on defense. They've got Chambliss. They've got Lacy. They've got firepower at receiver. Like, there's a lot to like, again, about this Ole Miss team. And so if you're not dealing with the distractions, yes, the schedule in the nine games in the SEC is hard, but this still looks like a team to me that can get to Atlanta and certainly make the college football playoff again.
Hey, shout out to Dealing with Dylan. Appreciate you for the donation. Joe Sloan, the fall guy for Stein, not calling the plays on offense, right? Stoops took the call sheet back from DJ Elliott and won 7 in 15.
Yes, he coached the game and we're trying to figure out the fall guy.
That's what I love
it. I love it.
I mean, that's hilarious. Like, I don't know where to go with that, but yeah, I mean, for all we know, maybe it was LSU. Maybe it was Garrett Nussmeier getting hurt. I don't truthfully believe that, but the issue there is the hire. when you're starting with a blank slate, so to speak, and you're Will Stein, we shouldn't be hiring someone that, best case scenario, we fire his ass in the middle of the year and we can take the play calling over. You know what?
I think maybe the most generous interpretation of these hires, especially like Jay Bateman and the guys on the offensive staff like Joe Sloan, they've been in the SEC. They bring SEC experience to a first-time head coach who is, he's only been an offensive coordinator. He was at Oregon for a couple of years, UTSA for a couple of years. Like, he's still pretty young and inexperienced on that side of the, just in running a program. So Maybe that's the angle to it, is that they get some experience to help a young coach. I will say Kentucky's coordinator hires are probably not among my favorite ones this offseason. I like Will Stein's offense a lot. I like his play calling. I just don't necessarily understand the staffing unless it's just a play for veteran experience. So, yeah, I guess I could see him taking back the play sheet sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and I want to shout out I want to see if I can upload this real quick. I got a interesting DM over the weekend, Stephen. Again, keep in mind, none of these, well, I should say none, but most of these spring games, right, not televised. I was literally at the Vanderbilt game, and I was like live tweeting it and sharing video and stuff. Meanwhile, at the same time, Kentucky had their spring game. So I don't know how I was supposed to watch the Kentucky game. Again, not televised, not streaming to my knowledge. Shout out Peyton B. He's locked his account since he sent me this. Not going to mention Kentucky's spring game. That mad that Kentucky has a better team in the Vols this year. So, again, you're a impartial observer here, Stephen. Maybe I missed it. Is Kentucky, they're better than Tennessee already? When did that happen?
Mike, I love the offseason optimism. So shout out there for being excited there about Kentucky ball. But I have a hard time seeing Kentucky finish ahead of Tennessee this year. You can call me out on it later at the end of the season if I'm wrong. I feel pretty good that Tennessee is going to be better than Kentucky. Albeit, I understand the optimism with Will Stein. I think Kenny Minchie had a pretty good spring game on Saturday, too. Taking spring games with a grain of salt as well.
Mm-hmm. We should have led with the Kentucky spring game that we didn't get to see, though. You know what?
Should have sent Cousin Shane up there.
All right. What is the next storyline for you this preseason, Stephen?
Mike, it's my favorite position to talk about. And so I am really excited that the SEC has a strong collection of quarterbacks, because this makes for like great ball. We got teams we'll start at the top, like Arch Manning, Trinidad Chambliss. Are they All-America good? Do they meet expectations? Do they take the next step? We've also got quarterbacks like Gunnar Stockton also trying to take a step forward. Can he be good enough for Georgia to win a national title? Lenora Sellers, trying to get back on track. Keelan Russell's development. Marcel Reed, John Mateer. Mike, I could go on and on. I think this is a really strong collection of quarterbacks with some guys who are going to be All-America caliber, some guys who are going to be maybe not on the All-America team, but very good. And there's also a lot of guys who I could see taking a step forward, plus guys with intrigue. So I can't wait for the quarterbacks this year.
Yeah, and remember this time last year, Stephen, though, there was a lot of hype with a lot of these quarterbacks. Shout out Arch Manning and Stephen and Paul Feinbaum. But I know that was like historically crazy talk, but it, not alone. Garrett Nussmeier was getting a ton of buzz. Of course, he got injured, so maybe that's not completely fair to him. John Mateer, one that was massive was Lenore Sellers. My God, did you see Lenore Sellers at the end of the year? If he could carry that over, Carolina's back in the playoff. Who else am I missing? I mean, Diego Pavia.
DJ Lagway.
That's a great one. So it just seemed like so many of these quarterbacks that were hyped in the offseason in the SEC were not ready to play due to a Talen Green, another one. You know, a lot of these guys did not live up to the hype. And I'm sure there's so many factors for why that was. But I'm wondering, Stephen, again, I support it. I've been supporting it since the beginning. But I wonder if these guys making millions of dollars, I wonder if that hurts in some regard. With the added expectations, added pressure, you could kind of take it easy a little. I'm not saying any of these guys are taking it easy, but if I was that age and I had that much money, it seems like it would be very hard to focus on a lot of things. So again, we'll see if that translates another season, because now these guys are making even more money. You know, does that factor into you. And that's not to say all these guys are going to bust out or anything. I don't think Arch Manning is at the strip club every night or anything like that. But do you see what I'm saying? Like, this is just like an added layer of things that we can't really quantify. If it happens where we have a lot of these star power quarterbacks and they largely fail to live up to expectations 2 years in a row, what, you know, do you think there'll be some credence to what I'm saying here?
I think there will be. I think if we have another year of high profile guys who maybe don't develop, let me take us in a little bit of a different direction too. Could you argue that this year's field of quarterbacks, like at the top, is maybe a little bit more established already? Like Arch was projection. Now it's not. Like, we've seen it. We've seen Trinidad Chambliss, because you could almost substitute like Chambliss for Austin Simmons in a way, because Simmons had the hype, Chambliss delivered. It feels like we've got a lot more data on these top guys. Thus, I think the hype is warranted, as opposed to last year. It might've been ahead of the curve. Does that make sense?
No, I think that's fair. I certainly think that's fair. And I was going through the list as you were saying that. Arch, certainly, Mateer, Marcel Reed, Gunnar Stockton, Trinidad, to a much lesser extent, but I think Austin Simmons, you could throw it, like, they know what they're getting there. Sam Leavitt, if he's, you know, assuming he's healthy, which I have no reason to believe he won't be. Byron Brown, Lenore Sellers. So, yeah, there's a lot of experience in this, except on Rocky Top. But besides that, I mean, there's in Alabama, I guess you could say too, but a lot of these guys are far more established, to your point, than they were last year.
And throw in Jared Curtis. I mean, a five-star true freshman, likely to start at Vanderbilt. Kamario Taylor, very high upside at Mississippi State. Arkansas, I think, has got two very capable quarterbacks. So, I mean, just trying to go from 1 to 16, it feels like this quarterback class has the right mix. It's like it's got the established guys. It's got the guys who are going to maybe develop, like the Taylor, Keelan Russell combo. And some also the Gunnar Stocktons, Marcel Reed, John Mateer, the guys that we think could maybe take a next step forward. So figuring out how to rank them 1 through 16 is a real challenge. But I think based upon what they did last year and maybe some of the portal moves around them, I feel pretty good about where this quarterback class is going. There were more questions last year, but I think this year, I think they're a little bit more established. So I think this year's collection of quarterbacks, I think, will be better by the end of next season for sure.
Mm-hmm. All right, Steven. So what would be the next storyline that you're thinking about this preseason?
Offensive line issues. And I think this is one, as I started to put together kind of a rough list of like the top offensive lines coming back in college football, Mike, you start to realize everybody's got questions. And so this is kind of leading me down a path of tying quarterbacks and offensive lines together. Texas A&M's got one starter back up front. Alabama and Auburn, none. Oklahoma, pretty promising core, but a young group. How does Texas get better on the offensive line? Georgia's got to replace its left side. We know LSU's question marks. Ole Miss is replacing both tackles. So big picture, Mike, a lot of the top contenders have offensive line question marks and issues, and which one of those are going to hit is going to play a pretty big role in determining, I think, the final standings in the SEC.
I'm surprised you didn't put this number one, Stephen, with as much as you talk offensive line, and it's so important. But yeah, I mean, who puts this together? Who struggles to do it? Who realizes their potential? Man, this to me is probably the biggest unknown going into the conference for so many of these teams, is who gets it done on the line of scrimmage, particularly on offense. I mean, even Alabama, they had so much success last year overall. But their failings on the offensive line truly held them back when it really mattered. And I think we could see that for a lot of these teams, particularly the teams that are trying to win at an elite level. This may be the position group that holds them back from actually accomplishing that.
It's also, I think, it's one of those with Texas last year, I mean, we knew they had questions, but you kind of just assumed that Kyle Flood and those guys, they would figure it out. It's kind of been my theory too at Oklahoma, like Bill Bedenbaugh is going to get the guys developed. They're going to hit, the offensive line's going to be fine. But I mean, I was kind of thinking back earlier this offseason that both Texas and LSU went into last year with question marks. And we kind of talked ourselves into like, hey, these groups are probably going to be fine. That didn't work out. And so, you know, just sitting there having this same thought, and we're going, hey, A&M's got all this turnover. Does Oklahoma's offensive line, we know Alabama's replacing, you know, everybody up front. You know, this is going to go probably a little bit under the radar because everybody's so focused on quarterbacks and skill talent. But to me, the offensive line discussion in this conference, there's a lot of questions, and I'm not sure that everybody has solidified all their questions as we wrap up spring practice at some of these teams.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I don't know how you work around that at this point in time, other than young players developing quickly. There's obviously no portal, secondary portal. So you kind of are what you are at this point in time.
Maybe the only good news would be the fact there isn't a portal and that you can focus on like, hey, we've got these three tackles and we have to develop one to be a starter and we got to get the other two ready to play in case of injury. So maybe that is, without a spring portal window, you can't get reinforcements, but you also know what you have and you can spend the summer developing or trying to figure out a way to game plan around it. I mean, we've already seen John Summerall kind of emphasize this already with his offensive line. So I think offensive line in general probably doesn't get enough weight in preseason predictions. I think this year, especially in the SEC, it's going to be even more critical because that middle of the conference is always hard to sort out. And a lot of these teams have a lot of questions there this year.
All right. So what would be your next preseason storyline?
It's a question that you asked Marler earlier today. And I think the dark horse conversation in the conference, I think going back to last year in the preseason, I think we talked about, hey, if this happens, Oklahoma could be a playoff team. If this happens, Texas A&M is going to be a playoff team. So like, which team that's not the odds makers favorite is going to be a playoff team this year? And you could go a million different directions that with this one, but we see the right coach comes in, John Summerall at Florida, pretty favorable schedule. How high could Florida climb? Does the Auburn offense just really take off with Byron Brown and Alex Golish? What about Alabama? Kind of funny to think about them as a dark horse, right? But most people don't have them in the top 10 to, 15 of preseason predictions. What if Keelan Russell hits? What if Austin Simmons really hits at Missouri? So I'm just, as we're going through the preseason prediction process, I always stop and ask myself, what team are we kind of sleeping on this offseason that if a few things hit, they're going to exceed our expectations? And that's the right one to call a dark horse and not like a Kentucky that's really kind of far off the radar.
Would Carolina fall into that category, Stephen, after winning 9 games 2 years ago? And, we have seen, I understand it because I'm guilty too. You led with Summerall, you led with Golish here. Those are almost like the shiny new toy, right? Where again, they got good rosters. They clearly didn't have good coaches. That's why there's been changes there. So it makes sense. I mean, those might be the best options, but Carolina's an established program. Missouri is an established program where we've made changes at each, but not massive changes. Necessarily, maybe we finally got the quarterback right at Missouri. Does Missouri and Carolina make more sense than Florida and Auburn?
I like them from the angle of continuity and establishment, basically. Just because I think as much as like they are the shiny object in the room when you're talking about the first year coaches, I mean, it is. There's going to be optimism and they are going to, I think, turn things around at like Florida and Auburn especially. But I think there could be something to like South Carolina's already established. We know what they have at quarterback. We also have seen them like South Carolina just got close to the playoff a few years ago. So I would take it from the angle of, I think instead of going new coach route, like you go with someone who's going to rebound, and both of those, because of our being already established, could easily fit the bill for sure.
Mm-hmm. Would you consider Tennessee in that mix, or are they already kind of perceived as potentially one of the teams that could make the playoff?
Do you think Tennessee's more of like a bounce back, and maybe South Carolina's kind of in that discussion too? Maybe the dark horses are like Florida, Auburn, Missouri.
I think that's fair, but I've been hearing a lot of negativity with old Tennessee, not among their fans, but among the rest of the SEC, where a lot of people are doubting Heupel, and, you know, has he reached a ceiling? Which, I mean, I understand why people are saying that, but I don't think that's accurate.
I think Tennessee's going to be a lot better on defense this year, Mike. I think Jim Knowles is going to make a big time impact. Mm-hmm. And I think this also kind of gets at our like establishment conversation, is if you're banking on establishment, Josh Heupel's track record of figuring out the quarterback situation and figuring out offensive strengths is pretty good. And so I would probably bank on that. You can have the ceiling conversation could be a totally different thing. Like, could Josh Heupel win a national championship at Tennessee is probably something totally different than, hey, can Tennessee be a dark horse or bounce back this year? And I do like Tennessee to bounce back this year to some extent. So I don't know, Mike, I'm not buying into the negativity around Tennessee this offseason.
Well, when I got Kentucky fans DMing me about how they're better than Tennessee, that tells you what some of these fans are thinking about them for some odd reason. You know what?
Feeling very good about a coaching change in transfer class, right?
I may send that crazy bastard some cheers because he's going to need it after that DM he sent me. All right, what would be the next storyline there, Steven?
Mike, this is kind of I got a few team-specific things here, because I think if you look at the top of the odds, you're going to find two teams at the top of most people's early predictions in the SEC. The first one is Georgia. My biggest debate around Georgia is, did they do enough in the portal to get over the hump? Because I think all of the teams at the top, whether this is Ohio State, whether it's Oregon, Georgia, Notre Dame, Texas, Indiana, I would probably put those six teams loosely as probably the top six by most. That group of teams is clustered so close together. And I wonder with Georgia offensively, you know, I think Gunnar Stockton will be better in year two, but I still want to see some more big plays in this offense. Very small transfer class, but potentially high on impact. And of course, Georgia's got a wealth of young players that are ready to step up. So I like where Georgia is positioned, but in order to beat like Ohio State, potentially Texas in the playoff, Oregon, I wonder, did they do enough to get over the hump and avoid being bounced out in the quarterfinals again this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, I plugged this on the Marler show, but just had Rusty Manziel on the show in studio. It was a really good interview, but you know, his point was they didn't spend a lot in the portal because it took a lot to keep that roster together.
Yeah.
You know, that's what fans never look at, is who you got, how much it costs to keep guys on the roster. So given the fact that this program's won back-to-back SEC, yeah. I know they haven't won in the playoff, which is all you're judged on by some people, but you know, that's not a bad strategy, Steven, bringing back the core of guys that led you to an SEC championship. I think that's a pretty strong, a strong method to winning big this season.
Yeah, I guess what I would say, Mike, is I hope it's not like the sky is falling, you know, they didn't do enough, they're going to regress. I think my question is, you know, I think Georgia, I'd put them in like I said, tier one to win the national championship this year. I could even make a case they should be number one. But I think the margins between all these teams in the top six or so are so small. And what I worry about offensively is like that limited ability it felt like to generate big plays, like we saw with Zachariah Branch last year. Well, he's gone. Can you generate those this year? And I love some of their younger receivers, like what we've been hearing in spring practice, what we saw. I mean, they got a wealth of talent, but it's hard to go 9-10 plays every drive. You got to be able to hit some plays over the top and score on three plays and a 50-yard bomb. Their portal class, like I said, is really high on like quality, not necessarily quantity, in roster retention. Like everybody's going heavy into the portal, and Georgia is doing something kind of totally different with roster retention. And I think it could pay off. But I wonder if we sit here in January and go, if they fell short, did they have enough at receiver to help Gunnar Stockton take the next step? And that's the question I'm kind of debating in my mind right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what other teams at the top there are you debating?
Texas. I think the biggest question is Texas going to meet expectations this season? Because, man, I got burned last year by putting Texas at the top. I've got my hand close to the stove this year. Haven't made the official number one ranking yet. But big picture, after a disappointing season, I wonder if there is a little bit of kind of national stock sell-off. And this is a good opportunity for, you know, whether it's people like me who think that Texas still has a chance to very much win the national title this year, to be right just a year later, because I love what they did in the portal with Cam Coleman, the running backs. I think the offensive line is better. But did they make the right acquisitions? Because after falling short last year, I think they did. But if they fall short 2 years in a row, there's going to be plenty of questions. So avoiding last year's disappointment, and can Texas meet expectations this year?
Steve is rarely wrong. He's just early.
Right. Maybe they accidentally printed 2026 predictions in last year's magazine, right?
So. Well, I mean, I don't want to say they caved to pressure, because I don't know that that's accurate. But if they did, won't they just be facing that again? And not only but added pressure. And I know they all come in here and they brag. We own the SEC. This wasn't so hard. We came in here and just dominated. Of course, we all know they had a damn cake of a schedule. And I have seen it, Stephen, where this is regarded as the toughest schedule in the Southeastern Conference this year. So it's flipped on them. Now, they may be better, but if the path is more difficult and if adversity strikes, I'm not sure they handled it very well. Never letting Sarkisian forget. He wants cameras on people as they go to the bathroom. I mean, that guy was cracking. I don't know if you guys remember, but he was falling apart at the seams, you know, midway point in the season. Can they handle a tougher path? I think that's a real question.
I think you said it best there. If they couldn't handle the expectations and didn't handle them well last year, there's nothing this offseason that was going to decrease expectations. Because I would be willing to bet there is going to be a lot of high-profile people in the media who pick Texas at one, and it's only going to ramp the pressure up. Now, I think the counter to that is they go into the year in better shape on the offensive line. I think we've seen Arch do it this year. It's not a question mark anymore. I think he was one of the better quarterbacks in college football down the stretch. They've got some of these, you know, they went out and got Cam Coleman. Feels like they'll be able to run the ball better, maybe a little bit more consistency at receiver. But I do worry about, you know, pressure plus schedule. Like you said, Ohio State, you got to play Oklahoma, Ole Miss, at Missouri, at LSU, at Texas A&M. That is very, very difficult. Now, 9-3 should get them in the playoff given that difficulty of a schedule, but we've already seen them struggle to meet expectations. Now it's going to be even heavier this year.
Mm-hmm. Any other big time contenders that you're questioning?
I've got two questions about teams that I would probably have to make the playoff right now. One is, can Pete Golding keep it going at Ole Miss? We've kind of talked already about maybe some of the doubts that are about this team. I certainly understand the regression conversation. Like, you lose Lane Kiffin, you go to Pete Golding, there's probably going to be some sort of changes, maybe some regression, but you still have a roster that is right there that made the playoff last year. They've made the right moves in the portal. So just in general, can Pete Golding keep Ole Miss going? And the tandem to that is, what happens with Lane Kiffin at LSU? Because I think they're one of the harder teams to figure out in the preseason rankings. I liked them as a playoff team way back in the early projections earlier this offseason. I would say undecided right now. Sam Levitt's foot injury gives me a little bit of anxiety. But the expectation, Mike, is not to go 8-4. It's college football playoff. So I am very curious how roster overhaul, coaching transition, pressure, how does that all add up in year one?
And then I realize there's probably no way to answer this question, Steven, but what if there's some, like you said, Texas 9-3, they should be in. What about LSU 9-3? Is it about how you got to that 9-3? You know, maybe closing strong, maybe questionable losses, you know, referee or, you know, if you're down your star quarterback and you lose, you know, I mean, are these the factors that would warrant a 9-3 team getting in?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in general, this is why they have a committee. They don't want to leave it up to the algorithms and the computers because they want, you know, a committee should be able to look at these teams and say, oh, they brought in X amount of transfers, so they struggled early, but they caught fire later in the season, and this is a better team now than it was in September. They're closing strong. Like you said, the injuries, like that all should be a part of the evaluation. So yes, and also would tandem that idea, Mike, because I do think who you lose to does matter. Like how you get to that 9-3 path. Like if LSU loses to like at Kentucky and Kentucky's a 4-win team, it might be hard. We saw this at Ole Miss. It might be hard to get in the playoff at 9-3 unless you just run the table of saying they beat Alabama, they beat Texas, they beat Tennessee. They could have maybe some weird losses, but if the wins are really good, that probably gets them in.
Mm-hmm. All right. How many other? You got any more storylines for us, Steven?
Got a few more. Got a few more for you, Mike. Let's go to Alabama, because I am fascinated by year three of Kalen DeBoer at Alabama. We talked a few weeks ago that Kalen DeBoer seems to feel pretty good about what they did in the portal. Maybe this transfer class is just better fits for what he and that staff want to do. Big picture, though, you know, it kind of feels like a season where it's going to define the tenure of Kalen DeBoer, because Keelan Russell could be very good in year one. And I would subscribe that he's probably going to be pretty good this season. If Alabama is maybe better than we think, they could easily start 2027 among some of the top teams in the country. But there are a lot of questions. And I think that's what DeBoer and the staff have a chance to answer. Revamped offensive line. Can you figure out the run game? You got this young quarterback. There's a lot of questions, but if you figure it out, this team's got a chance to get back to the playoff this year. So I just think, given the way last season ended with the blowout loss to Indiana, some of the questions, there's a real chance for DeBoer to kind of answer maybe some of the doubters if they can figure this out quickly in 2026.
And of course, Steven, DeBoer has worked with some very talented quarterbacks. Now, is that the DeBoer touch? You know, and he's made these guys. I don't know. I've I haven't followed really Penix or who was the guy he had with Fresno, went on to, I think, the Saints.
Jake Haener.
There you go. And yep. then Ty Simpson, of course, we'll see how he does in the NFL. But, I mean, he has made some developed some incredibly productive college quarterbacks, and he's likely working with the most gifted one he's had, at least if you believe in the recruiting rankings. You know, I mean, like, if they have a quarterback, Penix level quarterback, I mean, Alabama's going to be a tough out every week.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, look at that quarterback timeline, you know, Milroe, Simpson. I think Keelan Russell could be the best of that bunch. And then I think dating back to like Washington, you know, Penix is probably the one, you know, probably the, it's kind of hard to rate them all, but as far as like production, like on a high level, he was the best of this bunch of DeBoer quarterbacks. But I think that's kind of the offensive production that maybe you could see eventually out of him. Throw in, can they get Ryan Williams to be more consistent this year? You know, his drops were among the most in college football for a receiver last year. He's got to be better too. So DeBoer's and Ryan Grubb have really nailed the quarterback position. And that's so much a part of trying to exceed expectations, meet expectations. And I think I kind of almost trust them to figure that out this year. And so as much of it is a position with turnover, I'm almost penciling them in as like, I don't think it's a downgrade to have a new quarterback. I think my concerns are just elsewhere and being able to run the ball, more consistency, and especially how do they get that offensive line to potentially protect that young quarterback this year.
All right. Any other storylines, Steven?
Two teams that made the playoff last year, Texas A&M and Oklahoma. Can they almost buck the trend of teams that make the playoff don't make it the next year? We talked about it earlier, Mike. I mean, four teams made the playoff both years. So the odds say if you made the playoff as an at-large team, you're probably not getting back in 2026. So that's kind of the trend that Texas A&M and Oklahoma have to fight against. And I think a big part for both teams is what happens in quarterback development with Marcel Reed and John Mateer. Both those guys take a step forward. Both A&M and Oklahoma are either going to be make the playoff or they're going to be right there in the doorstep again.
Yeah, I mean, that is the challenge, isn't it, Steven? Sustaining success. You know, now they're going to have the target on their back every week. Not that they didn't before, but to a increased degree. Like, let's just take A&M for example here. Arizona State week two. Exactly to Steven's point. Well, I believe they won their conference, didn't they? I can't recall. But they made the playoff, and then they didn't make it the next year. As a, I believe, a favorite in the Big 12 this time last year. So that would be one. But maybe more accurately, Missouri or a Carolina or a Tennessee. I mean, so many where beating A&M, that may be the one that kind of gets these programs in. Same thing with Oklahoma. New coach at Michigan. I'm sure Michigan will... I don't know much about them, but I'm sure they'll be probably preseason ranked, but probably not top 10 or anything. A win over Oklahoma, that gets you back on the radar to jump into the playoff conversation. Same thing with, you know, maybe Florida late in the year. But basically, now you got that target on your back. And can you do it 2 years in a row? Tennessee sure as hell couldn't. I know that. So, I mean, most of these teams can't, to your point. And doing it, I mean, A&M's been striving to get to the playoffs for years and years and years. They finally did it. Now they got to get up off the mat and repeat that success. It's going to be tough to do.
It's always easier sort of like being the hunter as opposed to the hunted. You know, they're not sneaking up on anybody this year. They're not going to, you know, last year they were kind of – so I'd say most people probably had them just outside of the playoff. And so this year they will be either predicted to make the playoff again or probably just outside of it. So there's no doubt about what the expectation level is. We did see this weekend, Mike, Texas A&M spring game, Isaiah Horton showing up big in the spring game. I think that you know, that could be kind of massive for this offense, because you think about, you're losing Concepcion, who's so good at making plays, whereas you could throw the ball up and, you know, Horton can make some of those contested catches. So I think his development this spring was good for Marcel Reed. And of course, Mike Elko was pretty pleased about where things were this spring offensively for A&M. So far, so good. But they also have to buck that trend of teams that made the playoff missed it the next year.
Well, not only that, but I don't know why I'm thinking about this specifically, Stephen, but if you recall, in Oklahoma fans, they're being honest with themselves. When they lost to Ole Miss, they were like, God. I don't know if they were ready to fire Venables, but they were like, yeah, season's a bust. There's, you know, we're done. You can't lose that game at home. So, I mean, they were two-thirds of the way done with the season. They're like, there's no shot we're making a playoff. You know what I mean? So, yeah. I mean, you could be entering the last month of the season before you really find your footing. And, you know, can you do that this year with an added conference game? I don't know. I think you're going to have to hit the ground running.
Especially that game at Michigan could be make or break for a playoff spot. I don't, Michigan's probably going to be top 15 to 20 by most. I mean, swing games in terms of like playoff positioning, that looms large. You also have at Georgia, maybe the preseason SEC favorite, and then Texas in Dallas. Like that is three games against top 15 opponents, but essentially before you've reached the midpoint of the season. So they have to hit the ground running, because you still have to play, you know, Florida, Ole Miss, Texas A&M, and Missouri in November. So really there's no kind of runway for Oklahoma. They've got to get kind of firing on all cylinders at the start of the season.
All right. Any other preseason storylines for you, Stephen?
Got one for Cousin Shane. How far does South Carolina and Tennessee kind of bounce back, essentially? You know, the South Carolina nearly made the playoff in 2024, regressed pretty significantly. Tennessee didn't have that regression, that big time regression, but they missed the playoff. So curious if 2024 playoff or just missed teams, how far do they get back on track? And a lot of this goes back to South Carolina seems to have made the right moves on the offensive line, offensive coordinator, Lenora Sellers getting back on track. And for Tennessee, that defensive improvement. So really intrigued to see what kind of gains these two teams can make in the standings. And if you think those two teams are getting better, they probably have an impact on the teams at the top and the win totals too.
Yeah. I mean, I realize this is not what you're suggesting, but Tennessee at Carolina, who knows? That could be a playoff type game winner. You know, the loser, I certainly don't think has got much of a shot. Of course, Tennessee did lose at Arkansas the year they went to the playoff, but yeah, I mean, I think both these teams have a lot of reason for optimism, but at the same time, maybe some reason for doubt. Again, potential, not a big fan of Jimbo Fisher, but what did he always say about potential? Potential means you ain't done it yet. So, yeah, I mean, I could make the case for either one of these teams being, and maybe they both will, be a bounce back candidates this fall.
I do too. I think there's a good chance South Carolina is in some preseason top 25s this year because of the offseason improvements that they made. And I think Tennessee, I know the quarterback position is going to get a lot of preseason coverage, but I think there's a lot to like about everything outside of that. I know the quarterback position is pretty important, but I could easily see, despite the questions, the bounce back factor puts them in the top 25 and they finish there too this year.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any more storylines from you, Stephen?
I got two for you that I'm going to tandem together, Mike. Number one, which transfers hit or miss way more than we think, but also it goes into the luck factor in all this is like close games, turnovers, injuries. Which teams are going to do a better job at finding ways to win games on the margin? when we talked about those top six or so nationally that seemed pretty close. Sure seems like the SEC is pretty clustered with a lot of good teams in it. So finding ways to win on the margins, whether it's turnovers, injuries, the ball bounces your way, it's hard to kind of predict how that's going to happen. But I think those things that maybe we can't predict are going to have a massive impact on the season.
Well, and maybe one team that could benefit the most from that, Stephen, perhaps. How about Arkansas? Because that was one thing Ryan Silver Fox excelled at down in old Memphis. They were very good in turnover margin. They didn't turn the ball over. They took it away quite a bit. I think penalties too, they were really good at. So, I mean, these are the kind of the issues that has plagued that program for many seasons under Sam Pittman, turnovers and penalties. And, you know, if you can just get out of your own way, don't beat yourself. Again, over-under is 4.5. I'm not suggesting they're going to ride that all the way to the playoff, but, you know, other than Vanderbilt, probably just Vanderbilt, conference games, you're going to be picked against in every one of these. You know, you don't turn the ball over and you don't have penalties, you're going to beat a team or two or three in conference. Yeah. That nobody sees coming. I mean, that's in this NIL portal era. Again, just don't beat yourself. A lot of these other teams are going to, they'll be, you know, that's a key to a lot of these games that nobody ever talks about. Just don't beat yourself.
Yeah. And it's even like more crucial for Arkansas, just given I know we wonder about like, what does last year mean, but they've just overhauled the roster significantly. They have a new coaching staff. They have a ton of questions. Well, if you could play better defense and you're not beating yourself, you're going to give your chance to be like last year where, you know, you're in a lot of close games and maybe as the season progresses, you're getting better. So yeah, while the schedule is hard, I mean, week two on the road in Salt Lake City, it's a very difficult place to play. Don't beat yourself. Give your chance to go in there and beat Utah later in the season. You host Missouri, you get South Carolina coming to your place. Like, I think Arkansas gets better during the season. And one of the ways they can overcome some of their kind of deficiencies or question marks is going to be just don't beat yourself with penalties, turnovers, and kind of mistakes during the game.
Another team I think could fit that category, Auburn, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I think back to the A&M game. They basically just said, well, if we just punt every possession, these guys ain't beating us. And, I mean, they were right. You know, I mean, they only scored because of a A&M turnover. And I think you're getting a vastly different Auburn team this year, clearly. So, you know, that's another one that could be vastly different this fall.
Absolutely. I think offensive improvement, massive, probably, well, I shouldn't say massive. He hasn't coached a game in the conference yet, but an upgrade at the head coaching position. I mean, oddly enough, Auburn was +9 in turnover margin last year. So they didn't have good fortune in games, but they had semi-good fortune in turnovers. But yeah, I think new direction, I think, helps Auburn maybe exceed that win total there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any other storylines this preseason for you, Stephen?
Mike, I think that's the kind of the bulk of what I'm thinking about this preseason. I know.
Is that it?
No. Right. I was going to say, that's like a lot to throw out there, right?
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, 90 plus minutes talking some SEC football here in mid to late April. You can't beat that, and you can't beat the Athlon Sports College Football Preview Magazine, which Stephen is working his rear end off to accomplish and get that out to the masses. So, well, we certainly hope that when that's finalized, you each and every one of you that can, go out and get it. Support Stephen, support all the fine work they're doing it over at Athlon Sports.
Mike, I appreciate that, and I hope we've been talking about maybe some changes to our covers that I'm hoping to see to the finish line this year, which will be good for all the cousins. I think you'll appreciate that, and appreciate that if anybody, the best way to support the show and the magazine is to pick up that Athlon Sports preview magazine. Should be on newsstands late May, early June this year.
And we would also like to say thanks, Stephen, to Cousin Jared, who gifted a membership, I believe, to Old Cherokee Cooch. So shout out Jared and Karen, Cherokee Cooch. Welcome to
the family.
Yay! Appreciate you, Cousin Jared, for donating that membership. And oh, Shane. Shane's been a member for 8 months. Shout out Shane there. From all that money I'm sending him, he's buying memberships. But, all right, hey, Stephen, before we wrap up here, as always, please tell the cousins how to follow you and how to find all your great work over at Athlon.
AthlonSports.com, Mike. Plenty of college football coverage coming for the rest of the offseason, so I got you covered over there. At Athlon Stephen on Twitter, Stephen L. CFB over on Facebook and Instagram. And next time we talk, we should have hopefully some even more intel for the magazine.
Can't wait. Until then, Stephen, we appreciate all the knowledge you dropped on us. And we appreciate each and every one of you cousins for hanging out. We'll see you tomorrow with Cousin Shane. Get him off the golf course. Get him on the show. Until then, bye-bye.
Hey, buddy, this beer's for you, Mike, and Cousin Shane. That SEC podcast loves the pirate, and the pirate loves that SEC podcast. Hail State.